Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Vasilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 270, being recorded on the 13th of March, 2019. My name is Sajid, and on Skype with me, on Teams with me, we have Kale. And it's just Kale and myself today. Everyone else is kind of tied up with customer engagements. Customers always come first, and so we're going to run with the show today. And as a matter of fact, Kale had a nice idea for the show, which we'll get to in just a minute. But before we get there, let's just do a quick rundown on the updates. Kale, I noticed you put a few that in the show notes. Any ones that you'd like to start with?
Yeah, I'd say, well, actually going backwards, actually, in my list here, the first one that kind of stood out that I use a lot, and I'm sure our listeners probably use a lot, is an enhancement to the Azure Storage Explorer. There's a preview feature now that you can enable if you have the Storage Explorer. There's a preview menu that allows you to kind of turn on or toggle, you know, new features that are coming on, and one of them is AZ Copy for all the blob upload and downloads.
Good old AZ Copy, yeah.
Yeah, so we use that a lot, and it, I mean, if you take a look at the article, it actually talks about, you know, that's a pretty advanced tool for doing, you know, data transfer. So it does things to make things go much faster, and you can see the improvements there, you know, in some cases 100% improvement when you're talking about many little files. Even if you're talking about one large file, they have like a 10 gig file that you did a benchmark on, it was 50% faster. So if you want looking to save some time as you're uploading stuff to Azure, check out that preview feature in Azure Storage Explorer.
Nice. Very nice. I noticed there was also an update for the VNet transit mode, which seems kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. Like, I didn't understand what that was till I kind of looked at it deeper, and I was like, that's kind of interesting. Have you used it, Sajid?
No, but it helps folks who use ExpressRoute, I suppose, right, the most.
Yeah, probably. But also, it works with VPN, right? So, like, essentially, instead of, like, for on-premises connectivity to the cloud, you know, typical you would set up a gateway and then you would have this tunnel that you would use there. This allows you to essentially share some of those gateways that you have up there. So you're allowed to, you know, while a gateway is being used for VNet to VNet traffic, it could also be used for on-premises to cloud connectivity.
Right. And it does help if you have VNet peering, right? Because you can share the gateway across all the VNets now. That are part of the peer.
Totally. I'm a huge lover of the peering, by the way. If you haven't used that either, it's so fast. you know, so it's so easy to just go in there and basically check a couple boxes and you have connectivity across the world. It's pretty awesome.
It is, yes. Although I did have problems with getting VNet peering to work with Redis cache recently. I was trying to do, you know, to set up two Redis caches and do the replication of the Redis cache. And that there is a problem with that approach. If it doesn't work through VNet peering, it only works if you do, you know, direct access from Redis cache over the internet, which kind of, it's not what most people want. So it's not always good, but yeah, I agree with you. That's a good feature, VNet peering in general. What else we got there?
I had another one here. We talk about this from time to time about things like monitoring what's going on with your services up in the cloud. And there's a service called Azure Service Health, which allows you to basically kind of keep track of what's going on with services that are running up there, take action, you know, if there is, you know, some downtime that's happening. And it's a pretty nice dashboard that the team's been working on for quite some time. These things continue to get deeper and deeper insights, and, you know, a bit easier for you to hook up things like alerts to let you know if there is any degradation in the service or whatnot. You're alerted to the fact.
Right.
I love the 3D barcodes, by the way, too, on mobile. So you can basically, if there is an issue, you can, on the issue page, there's a 3D barcode, and you can, like, scan it on your mobile phone. If you have the app on there, then it keeps track of it, and it'll ping you.
Oh, nice.
As it changes. It's pretty cool.
Okay. That's a nice kind of loading feature. Well, another thing that we do with Azure Monitor, you know, has a smart detection feature where we can detect certain conditions are going bad, for example, and send emails and notifications to whoever subscribed to it. And by default, they go to the subscription owner, the subscription contributor, and the subscription reader roles. And what happened is, you know, these roles will include users who are now no longer, you know, interested in those particular emails. So as a result, they get spam mail, and, you know, nobody likes spam mail. So they kind of tweak those roles a little bit, and now the email notifications only go to the monitoring reader role and the monitoring contributor role. And therefore, you can, you know, clearly define who gets those emails instead of giving it to all the default roles. Just a little bit of help for the monitoring folks. All right, I think that's a good roundup on all the news. Thank you for all of those tidbits. So let's get to the topic that we wanted to discuss today, aptly called Hammer and Nail. So why don't you start with explaining what, you know, what your thought was around that, Gail?
Yeah, so I was talking to the team here before the podcast about a topic that I was thinking maybe we should do. And the idea was, you know, this hits me pretty close with blockchain, working in an area of Azure that's a little bit unique in the service that it provides or the features that it provides to our users. And a lot of times what happens with services, and not just blockchain, I mean, this could be any kind of data platform, compute, whatever, you want to kind of avoid the syndrome that happens, which is called the hammer and nail approach, which is, you know, I got this really cool technology that's fancy and I really like tech, or I really like how this thing looks, so I need to figure out how to work that into my solution versus, you know, basically I have a business problem I'm trying to solve. I need to build a solution for it. And what are my options and how do I evaluate that and make sure that I'm picking the proper service for it instead of just one that might be, you know, just because of personal preference or other outside reasons.
That yeah. Kind of I see that all the time, you know, especially if you're and you have a developer mindset or something like that, you're kind of very excited to try all the new services that are out there in Azure are coming out. And then you figure out, it's like, okay, here's a solution and looking for a problem for the solution instead of, you know, taking a holistic approach. And I agree with you. I guess blockchain is a good one, right? People sometimes throw a lot of things in the blockchain bucket. What are you seeing in that area? Let's start with that.
Yeah, I think what you need to do, and again, I was trying to think about this a little bit more abstractly as opposed to saying, you know, I have specific guidance that I go through with folks when they say, I got the ultimate thing here, we're doing this solution, we're going to do it on blockchain, and here's why. And then I have this kind of thing that I go through where I'm like basically vetting it to see if it actually meets the smell test of should we run this on blockchain, does it make sense, those kind of things. But to pull back a little bit from that, the things that I'm actually looking for are basically every one of these services has a kind of a sweet spot about what they're trying to drive to, right? In blockchain's world, it's very much about decentralization. It's very much about, if you think about a traditional B2B system in the past using things like EDI or some of these integration systems between them, you know, that's one model of integration so that two companies can talk. But if you think about a different kind of world where that's a bit more decentralized in the fact that neither one of those parties has total control over what's going on, we have essentially a shared data area that people are using. We have some shared code that they're executing. These are kind of some of the big things that stick out when you start thinking about, does this make sense for blockchain? If people are just looking for, let's say, for instance, global scale data platforms, it may or may not be blockchain, right? We have great technology in things like CosmoDB and even SQL Server that allows stretch clusters to go, you know, inside region or even outside region. And so I think a lot of times with blockchain, people get a little bit confused around global distributed system and decentralized. And so it's really trying to kind of nail that down and say, does this really make sense? Because you're incurring some overhead, right, to take on this new technology stack. And you want to make sure that the price you're paying for that is going to benefit you.
Yeah, so that's a good point, though. So when I think of decentralized, what it means to me is that there could be a lot of different parties involved, right, in whatever you're trying to do. Whereas global, it just could mean that you just want to be all over the world. Is that how you kind of separate the two, just to kind of clarify that terminology?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a little nuanced, right? So that's why I think some there's a lot of confusion around it. I think people struggle with that sometimes. And then, you know, there's the lure of the tech that brings people in. And so that's...
Well, how much do you focus on the data when you come to these things, right? Because in any solution, there's always data. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously when you come in blockchain, people think, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the distributed ledger is what they think about. And Cosmos DB has, of course, the concept of collections and whatnot. How much should we focus on the actual data, the data model, like what kind of data, how it's being processed, et cetera? How does that play into our choice here?
No, I think that's a good question, too. And it really, again, this comes down to what kind of solution are you trying to build? If you're building something where it's a kind of top-down approach, where you're building an application that essentially people are going to consume, in that respect, maybe something a bit more centralized makes more sense, right? As opposed to something where multiple businesses are going to be feeding in either logic or how the system actually works, instead of a top-down approach, it being a bit more of like, I guess I'll call it a community type approach, where the businesses are truly working together and they're all on the same footing. There's not one company kind of pushing, you know, this is the model, this is how we do things. It's much more distributed or decentralized. Yeah.
Okay. So, so that's one kind of clear aspect. I know the other one that I have faced quite a bit done some work in containers and Kubernetes is a lot of people think containers is kind of the solution for everything, right? Oh, you know, it's going to solve all my problems. And that's another area that I'd like to discuss is, you know, so so the problem that people are trying to solve, right? The fundamental problem is that they have a data center that they want to evacuate, let's say. And they want to have legacy applications and want to move all of that to the cloud. And they often think that, I'm just going to throw all this in the container and wash my hands off it and the problem's going to go away just because they've heard about this. I'm sure have you ever heard of that kind of talk with customers, Cale?
For sure. It seems, again, like it's the new thing. So everybody's like, well, of course we're going to containerize it. That's what everyone's doing.
Yeah. And, one of the things that I tried to kind of ground people, customers in that discussion is containers is relatively a new technology, right? Yes, it's been in Linux for 15 years, but, you know, nobody ever knew about it until Docker came around and created this tooling to help people take advantage of the containers and the container technology that was always built into Linux. But the whole containers, as we know it, is, you know, barely 4 to 5 years old. And so, trying to take a system that was built 15, 20 years ago, like a Windows Server 2003 or I guess maybe some older version of Linux and trying to retrofit that inside of a container system is a little bit, you know, I caution about, you know, the stability of that because you just don't know what's going to happen. The older system was Nest Number built to run on a modern host. And so you have to be careful just throwing that into a container. Sometimes you may have to just step back and take a look at what other compute options you have inside of Azure. For example, there's things like nested VMs, you know, where you can kind of do nested virtualization, I think is the way you describe it. So that's another option for you when it comes to taking legacy systems and moving them into Azure. But I always wonder, what about legacy data, right? Legacy databases. Yeah. How do you what have you seen in terms of migrating, let's say, a really old Oracle DB or IBM DB2 system, for example?
Yeah, before we touch on that, I wanted to touch on the container thing. One other thing, I had a question for Usagi. People start, embracing containers and Service Fabric and all these other kind of I guess you'd call them container platforms. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a ramp there, right? So initially, if you start dipping your toe in the water with Docker, there's things like Compose. Right, which is basically a very simplified orchestration mechanism that allows you to say, hey, here's a JSON file that kind of describes the containers I want to run on this host. And then you move up to things like Kubernetes, where it gets much more advanced with pods and all kinds mm-hmm. of things. And so, what's your experience been there? Because I know you work pretty deep in containers, how do you know when to say, yes, we're going full in with AKS and Kubernetes versus, guys, all we really need is, Docker Compose and a couple hosts here?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So typically, I tell the customers that if they have containers that are not related to each other, right, they could be a disparate set of applications that don't really talk to each other or don't have to be deployed as a unit. You could, your kind of options for hosting those kind of things are much bigger, right? You can put them into ACI, which are single container instances, or use app services, which also host containers now. So for simpler solutions, those are actually cheaper and maybe easier to get started. But the moment you get into a realm where you have applications that are talking to each other, maybe involve a database and must be deployed as a package, you need something to tie it all together. And at that point, Docker Compose can take you only so far, because it all it does, it says, I got to deploy these three things together, but it doesn't really allow you to say, I need, five copies of them, or I want to make sure that they are distributed, evenly in all my servers and things like that. For that, you need something like an orchestration engine. Of course, Docker themselves make an orchestration engine, Docker Enterprise, or you could use Service Fabric, which is our own Docker orchestration engine. And of course, the popular choice today is Kubernetes. But irrespective of which orchestration engine you select, that's not the topic of this discussion. You need to use an orchestration engine once it gets past, the point where you have just a few disparate applications that you want to deploy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I think that's good guidance around knowing when to go really deep on advanced orchestration engines versus super lightweight ones, kind of thing.
Yep. And that even in that area, right? I mean, I know from Microsoft perspective, our customers are often coming from a Windows world. So although, we don't really, we try to stay away from that when talking about a solution, but just have to consider it, because containers in Windows is very mature, but not as mature as containers in the Linux world. So you have to kind of also consider that, deploying an application into a Windows container environment, while it is supported, is not as advanced and mature as the Linux workload. So that's something to consider.
Super, super important, the maturity. That goes across everything. That's not just containers. I think about blockchain, even database technology. If you're bleeding edge, expect some bumps, because that's what happens. And if you want something more mature, it tends to be things that have been around for a while, a little bit. So it's an interesting area as well. But sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt that, but you had to ask the question about the legacy databases.
It's probably a good segue to talk about, how customers think about data, right, when we're trying to migrate it. What are you seeing out there on that end?
Yeah, I think, from the time when I did a lot of this, when moving around, migrating data or bringing things to the cloud, and a lot of times that comes up when it's a lift and shift type thing where, I have these existing databases. Oh, we'll just put them on the cloud. And then you find out it's some exotic, weird thing that they have set up, or it's a really advanced kind of cluster that they need to run there or something like that. So I think the big thing there, as always, we've done kind of shows talking about lift and shift is understanding, you know, what can change, what needs to stay, you know, basically is a big thing. Because if we say, hey, we're running this on some really old database technology, let's say, and we really don't want to change it because there's no money for us to essentially migrate this, then what options do we have? Is there a containerized workload that we can, to your point, potentially stand it up and run it like that, so we have it kind of isolated and it'll be, you know, dealt with at a later time, versus, you know, a full-on migration and saying, hey, yeah, is it easy for us to just bring our schema and some of the logic that we're doing here into, you know, SQL Server, Cosmo, these kind of things?
Yeah. And I just want to caution one thing, though. I am generally against the notion of containerizing a database, only because in my mind, containers are meant to be ephemeral for the most part. I know there's also things like stateful containers, the stateful pods that they have in Kubernetes, but I think those are kind of one-off. I don't expect people to run a full-fledged production database inside of a containerized system, only because you know, you have to, you're going to face a performance penalty because you take a some kind of a volume persistence that you have to configure, and that's not always the best. So I think, you know, using a managed service in Azure, a managed data service like SQL, Azure, or preferably Cosmos DB, or even our managed, don't we have like a managed Progress and I think MySQL, et cetera. So those are the you know, preferred options when moving to Azure with your data. I don't think, you know, using the container for data is a good idea.
No, I think that's a good point, and that kind of leads into something else, you know, about, you know, should I ever be, if I'm sitting here at a customer, or I'm the customer myself, should I ever be thinking about installing something bare metal?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I got all these managed offerings in the cloud, I have containerized kind of workloads. What, why should I even be thinking about ever, or maybe I shouldn't be, you know, the bare metal hardware?
Yes. So when you say bare metal, you mean stay on-prem? Is that what you mean?
No, I mean, bare metal to me even could be, you know, an ISVM. So I'm just going to stand up an ISVM and I'm going to bare install this thing versus, you know, the alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, and just to be clear, there are some scenarios where using a bare metal option is probably the only option, especially if you have custom software that, you know, I mean, maybe something like an SAP or whatever, one of those kind of applications where you just have to run it in bare metal. I think even Oracle, for example, there is no managed offering. You just have to kind of do it yourself on bare metal. But, you know, moving something to bare metal or considering bare metal in our ISVMs, you only get some of the efficiencies of the cloud, right? All you're buying at that point is the fact that I don't have to host this in my own data center. And that's the one thing. So you maybe gain some sort of capital expense benefit out of that. But everything else remains the same. You still need the staff, and you still need all the operational overheads. All of that is going to remain the same. And worst of all, you cannot, your business cannot innovate any faster than it did on-prem, because you're still limited by that, the fact that you still have to provision new servers when you need to scale out. You have to do all that magic, etc. So I, you know, I don't think that that is the first option that people should consider when moving to, like, I should not be the first thing that comes to mind, but I understand that in some cases it is the only option.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that comes up there, and maybe it's a little bit more on the edge of like research or kind of the cutting edge development stuff, where, you know, when you talk about managed offerings, typically those are pretty hardened services, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, they are hardened services, but they're, you know, stable versions and those kind of things. So when you're looking to do more advanced things that are, you know, like experimental or even considered pre-release, there definitely is some options in the cloud for some of that stuff. And the teams kind of push that up as much as possible. You see it in form of like preview services and even private preview type stuff. But beyond that, maybe that's another case where if you are doing something super bleeding edge, IaaS might be your only option in certain cases, you know.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. I'd like to, if it's okay with you, move on to communication, right, between servers. There's many ways that we can communicate between our compute environments. We've got things like Service Bus, Event Hub, Event Grid, IoT Hub now, all these various options. I mean, like, where do you, when customers, want to do something, and of course, blockchain itself is a, gigantic eventing mechanism. When you talk to customers about their solutions, where do you start with, when it comes to communications?
Yeah, so like on, I'll call it like integration services or things like that on the edge with like message bus technology. It varies a lot, right? Because particularly, and you mentioned blockchain, like one thing that happens a lot there is people are very interested in when certain things happen on the blockchain, essentially, and events kind of bubble up. And so basically being able to consume those in an easy way at your own kind of pace, because the whole notion of these enterprise service buses is to kind of decouple the consumer from the producer, so that there's a queuing mechanism in most times, and a scaling motion that can happen there, so that you can absorb, think about IoT with millions of devices, how can I absorb that kind of load instantly? So those are big things that kind of stick out for me, like especially around blockchain, to say, hey, if we're gonna start, pumping, have a big message pump that's gonna sit on top of the blockchain, these technologies kind of lend themselves very well to their Event Grid, things like that, so that I can then start building custom processing engines that can use that for other business purposes that we're doing. So that's probably the biggest area, like for communication from like a message bus standpoint.
Yeah, I know a lot of people, their default position is to use something like a service bus because it's an enterprise messaging environment. But I think, you should look at what are the requirements of the data, right? Do you really need that kind of that level of reliable guarantee? Because that comes at the expense of performance. So using something like an event hub sometimes is a lot faster, or in some cases, if you just need eventing, you could use something like an event grid, which is really fast. But the one area that I have struggled with sometimes is when you use IoT Hub, and I know IoT Hub is often used in the terms of edge devices and IoT devices, but under the covers, it's basically it's a variant of the Event Hub that we have, and so. With IoT device, can we kind of reuse something like an IoT hub for general purpose eventing? Is that a good idea, or should each one have its own place? What do you think?
I think from my angle, there is just like you said, that has been, it's like a customized version of Event Grid or that technology stack for IoT. So it's adding in the pieces that also will complement the IoT solution. So certainly if that makes sense in your solution, like you need things like the gateways that are going to plug into there and some of the things that happen inside of IoT suite, that certainly makes sense. But I start thinking like, yeah, you're using the wrong tool for the job if you're saying, I just have general messages that I want to kind of post up here and then I'm going to have a consumer reading them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why you would ever go with IoT Hub then, because there's much more advanced capabilities over there for like devices and how devices get configured and be able to talk to the hub, which have no relevance, when you're talking about just like plain old servers or computers or something like that, as opposed to a low powered IoT device. So I think that starts to blur the line there a little bit, where like, do we really need that, or can we just go back with kind of the general ones, that we can use?
Yep.
And the other thing that comes up there a lot, like we talk about Event Grid being really fast and Event Hub and these things being super fast technology, but there are some workloads that even that's not good enough. So that it's another thing to watch out for, especially around financial transactions or trading type applications. While we have things like guaranteed messaging and very fast scaling, kind of things, so we can really go wide with these services, it doesn't necessarily mean they'll be delivered the next nanosecond.
Right.
And in trading, that's key. So,
Let's not forget about the Signal Azure Signal R service, right? Which helps in those scenarios. That's another one that came up recently. It's kind of used more for end users to connect and to get data, but that's another option out there for you for real-time data. Well, that's the thing, you know, with Azure, there's all these services, and it's like a little puzzle sometimes getting the right services to work within your solution. But as you said, Kale, try not to use, a hammer too often.
Yeah, I think the thing there, people always ask for guidance around that because it's kind of like a hard problem to solve, right? It's like, well, I would have used that technology if I'd known it existed. And because the landscape is so broad now, maybe it's sometimes people will use the wrong service, not even knowing that there's a better service to do what that is. And that's, for me, people always come and ask, like, how do I know about these things? Like, how can I possibly keep up with all the stuff that's running in the cloud? And I'll tell you, like, one little cheat thing, I'm Sujeet probably has done this too, but as Azure was growing and all these services were being added, we have things like, our certification programs for like Azure, for infrastructure and dev and these kind of things. And a lot of times people kind of, I've heard, basically kind of blow them off. Like they're kind of like, I mean, these are good things to get and they help you get a job because people understand like what your knowledge base is and you have a certain set of base knowledge around these type of technologies. But those things give you exposure to things you might not have seen before, right? Because you don't get to every day spin up an IoT hub. And so maybe, those are kind of good refreshers as those things come out to kind of take a look at because it helps you kind of keep up to date with everything we just kind of talked about, like the compute platform, the storage platform, the messaging platform. And then and sometimes people will take the test and say, well, nobody ever does it that way. But you now know about that service over there. So that's good for you to know because now you know the attributes. And later when you're approached with a problem, you can say, hey, I know what fits best here.
Yep. And one kind of very handy resource, another resource I want to point our users to is on the Azure portal. We have there's two sections now. There used to be just the product section, which are the services, all the Azure services that we had. And there are, of course, hundreds of those, which can be confusing sometimes to go through. But then they have the solutions section right now, which if you click on that, that kind of gives you a bunch of solutions. And they're even broken down by industry. So you could, solution architectures, migration centers, et cetera. And these have things like, decentralized identity, DevOps, if you just want to run Red Hat, that's all you care about, or Dynamics, or Business Intelligence, Disaster Recovery, Gaming. So they're kind of broken down more into solution sets that way, and then you can drill down there, and then they kind of narrow down the list of Azure services that should be within your consideration, right? They don't throw you into all of this. They just say, okay, these are the ones that you need to look into instead of just looking at the entire suite of Azure services. So we'll put a link to those in the show notes. That's been good, Gail. What else do you want to talk about? Anything else you think we should cover today?
No, I hope the listeners find this helpful. I mean, the biggest advice I can give is when you're approached with a problem, try to keep an open mind and think about, the various attributes that are important to make that solution work and use that to drive your technology focus and your services as opposed to maybe just leaning on what you already know kind of thing.
Yep, I agree. Well, Scale, this has been great. We'll hope to see everyone back next week. We have a special guest next week, very interesting topic. So we'll wait until then.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.